Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Julia Snieringer, author of the book A Social History of Early Rock and Roll in Germany, Hamburg from Burlesque to the Beatles, 1956 to 69. Julia, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
And we're glad to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Well, I'm currently a professor in the City University of New York system. My main gig is at Queens College, and I'm also affiliated with the CUNY Graduate Center. I am basically a historian of modern Germany who also works in, I'm interested in history of music, particularly popular music. I'm a social historian of culture. That's kind of, I think, the label that I give myself most. I'm interested in youth culture, sex and gender, entertainment, history of leisure. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. I think of myself as working at the intersection of quite a few different things.
That really comes across in your book because you bring together so many fascinating elements. And I think you do yourself a bit of a disservice there in your description because you also incorporate politics and how that effort of sort of how officialdom grapples with issues like youth culture and youth society. What was it that led you to write a book that incorporated all these elements?
Well, the first impulse for this was a personal experience that I had. When I was an exchange student in Hamburg in 1986, right, so I'm dating myself a little bit here, I stumbled across a funeral procession for a nightclub in Hamburg's St. Pauli neighborhood, which is down by the harbor. And it was a funeral march for the Star Club. Now, if you're a Beatles fan, you might have heard of the Star Club. It's one of those places that they played in Germany back before they were famous. And the club had been burned out in a fire and it was about to be torn down. And I sort of stumbled across, you know, 1,000 people or so walking through the street, you know, mourning the imminent demise of a nightclub. And, you know, I was fresh off the airplane. I mean, this was one of my first experiences of Germany. And I was really struck by these Germans being so invested in rock and roll. And, you know, it sort of got me thinking about, you know, what did rock and roll mean to them in their particular context? You know, because I imagine that rock and roll probably meant something slightly different to them than it did to me. You know, when you grow up in the States in the 70s and the 80s, you know, rock and roll was certainly a big part of my life. But I don't think it had quite the same social and cultural power that it once did. And so, you know, sort of witnessing this funeral march for a nightclub that had its heyday in the 60s had me thinking about this idea of what did rock and roll mean in the 60s in Germany. So, you know, I just sort of had this and I filed this away in the back of my head. I wasn't even really a historian at that point. I was more of a German language and lit student. So, you know, flash forward a few years, I ended up going to grad school for history. And I was certainly interested in sort of popular culture. But, you know, when I was a grad student, late 80s, early 90s, it was still a subject that I think was struggling for legitimacy. And it certainly wasn't really encouraged in my particular program. So, you know, I ended up doing my dissertation on Weimar Germany, women getting the right to vote. I did a study of political propaganda aimed at women voters. So, you know, what you said earlier about political history, I mean, I totally come out of political history. But there too, I mean, you know, I was interested in combining sort of political history with social history, lived experience, in this case of women voters. So, you know, I had this sort of idea about writing a history of rock and roll in Germany floating around in my head for a long time. But, you know, I sort of felt like I had to prove my bona fides by doing something that was a little more, I don't know, respectable or sort of, you know, hard science-y kind of stuff like politics and parties. But then, you know, when you get to book number two, when you get to write your second book, I think there's a lot more freedom. And so I really took advantage of that. And, you know, I began working on this book about 20 years ago in earnest. And, you know, I sort of, by that point in time, I was, you know, I was a trained historian. I understood things like, you know, archives and contextualization and periodization. And so I began to fashion this project, thinking about rock and roll in this particular time and place. And, you know, the time and place was Hamburg in particular. You know, when I lived in Hamburg, I was always struck by this incredibly lively scene of people who cared about older music, music collectors, you know, revivalists of 60s bands. And I mean, I just thought to myself, Germans seem to have a very different relationship with this music. And I was just fascinated by that. And so what I did with this book was to try and, you know, bring the historian's eye to this particular topic. So that's where we get the place that we get. And as I began researching rock and roll, it became clear to me that rock and roll was, it was certainly something new in the late 50s, early 60s, but it would not have been able to exist without an older set of, you know, places, people, you know, economic relationships and all that. So then, you know, then you start sort of digging backward into the history. And that's how I ended up writing a lot about San Pauli and the long history of entertainment in San Pauli. So, you know, that's a long-winded, a long-winded way of sort of maybe getting this thing started.
I was wondering if you could perhaps explain a bit that context, the San Pauli district, the its relationship to Hamburg, and also, you know, how it emerged out of World War II, because as you explain in that chapter, it had undergone, you know, quite a dramatic series of transformations as a result of the immediate events that were taking place. And here I'm not thinking just about, say, the war or even the Third Reich, but I'm thinking also about how you describe, you know, it's a place that is oftentimes at the forefront of a lot of the broader social and cultural changes that are taking place regarding gender, regarding society in Germany and Europe more generally in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Hamburg is a port city, and I think port cities are by definition interesting, right? They're crossroads of people, they're crossroads of commodities, they're crossroads of ideas. So, you know, those kinds of places I think are inherently interesting. And, you know, so Hamburg is this port city of longstanding connections to networks of trade and all that kind of thing. And then within Hamburg, the neighborhood that sits right there at the port, San Pauli, is itself this centuries old, you know, crossroads of people and tourists and merchants and, you know, invading armies and, of course, first and foremost, you know, sailors and seamen. And wherever you've got sailors, you're going to have nightlife, you're going to have sailor bars, you're going to have prostitution. And so, you know, what I began to learn was that Hamburg and San Pauli had this longstanding infrastructure of providing amusement, and that's the word that they always use. Vergnügung is the German word. So this idea of amusement. So they actually, you know, they build up a literal infrastructure of places that you can go. And so, you know, so the history of the rise of an entertainment district in San Pauli is something that happens right alongside the more familiar stories of the rise of, you know, industrialization and urbanization. And so, you know, a big part of what I ended up thinking about in this book is the ways that a modern entertainment economy is very much a part of those other stories of industrialization and urbanization. They all work together. So let's see, you asked me a lot of questions in there.
Sorry. Well, I was thinking about how you describe how it's a place that also is dealing with a lot of the changes in terms of gender relationships as a result of industrialization. And then you have, of course, the Weimar era and the shifts that are taking place there, as you don't have quite the same, you know, conservative social dominance. But then you get to the Third Reich, and you have this, you know, additional disruption that takes place with, you know, the greater regulation of the German state and its restrictions on certain types of music that it sees as very as alien, as un-German, and how that forces that really imposes a lot of pressures upon the St. Pauli district that are very relevant to what happens in the post-war era.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, entertainment makes money, you know, so the city has an investment in, you know, sort of regulating and, you know, making money off of taxation. But at the same time, they want to create a sort of safe touristic product that, you know, that you can, so that the average tourist can go down there and, you know, enjoy something that's risque, but at the same time, not feel like they're risking life and limb. So the dynamics of tourism are another really important part of the story of St. Pauli. You know, I mean, as we go into the sort of early 20th century, St. Pauli is really interesting because it is most known for being this amusement district, but at the same time, it's also the port, right? So it is very much a working class neighborhood. And it's also a neighborhood that has this sort of, you know, sub-working class, the lumpenproletariat element of criminals, people who live very marginal existences. And so, you know, it's a small place. It's not much bigger than a square mile in its original contours. But within that square mile, it's incredibly packed with all these different impulses. So, you know, in the 1920s, you know, we have the rise of one really famous nightclub in particular, the Alcazar, which, you know, in its day was as famous as anything in Berlin. And, you know, this particular club was a stop for American artists, for example, you know, Josephine Baker, the Chocolate Kitties, Billy Thompson's groups, you know, people that become famous in the history of jazz. Hamburg becomes an important stop on their itinerary. So, you know, this influx of popular music from America, you know, is an important cultural trend in the 1920s, and Hamburg is an important stop on that itinerary. When the Nazis come in 1933, they try, on the one hand, to completely enact their sort of cultural and racial agenda, right? So, you know, they step in early on and they shut down the gay bars. You know, African-American performers, foreign performers can no longer work there. And that's even something that slightly predates the Nazi. That's actually a Depression era, you know, decree. And, you know, hot jazz, you know, becomes sort of verboten, although the definition of what's actually allowed and what's not is often very confusing. But then at the same time, you know, they've got this tourist product that they need to sell. You know, St. Pauli is an important generator of revenue. And so, you know, the Nazis want to clean up the area somewhat, but they can't sanitize it because that would kind of, you know, kill what people are coming there for. So the Nazis, what they basically try and do is corral, control, keep the unruliest elements out of sight. They talk often about cleaning up the sort of street level face of the district, while at the same time, it's clear to everybody who wants to find, you know, prostitution or, you know, unlicensed dancing. It's kind of, you know, you can still find these things. So the Nazi period is really interesting in showing, you know, the attempt to control, but also the limits of how much the authorities can actually control St. Pauli. St. Pauli is a very unruly place. And, you know, once the Nazi period is over and the war is over, that unruliness just really roars back out into the open, you know, even in the late 40s when there's, you know, when provisions are scarce and there's not much to eat, you know, people are dying to go out dancing. You know, they don't care if the cocktails are mostly sugar and colored water. People have this intense desire to relax, to amuse themselves, right? And in the 1950s, that blossoms into a real golden age. And that's the phrase that they use all the time to describe the 50s, you know, a golden age of tourism on the Reeperbahn in particular. People are coming from all over Northern Europe to go to St. Pauli. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that it's accessible by rail. This is, you know, the 50s are still an era when people aren't flying to remote destinations yet for vacation. So St. Pauli really benefits from people wanting to relax, people having more disposable income, but, you know, not yet being so flush that they can afford to, you know, take a trip to Thailand or whatever. And it's out of that 50s tourism boom that the rock and roll clubs are born, in a sense.
There's another element in your book, though, that is so vitally important to the story, and that is that as you're describing the birth of these rock and roll clubs, you're also describing how Germans are coming to terms with being German in this post-war context. We're talking about it's the immediate aftermath of World War II. You have a lot of the guilt associated with the knowledge of the Holocaust, the international, sense of judgment about that. And as you describe, a lot of Germans are in Hamburg and elsewhere are looking outside of Germany for something that they can connect with, that they can enjoy, that they don't feel quite so guilty about. And that was an element that I thought was really fascinating, because you describe how eagerly they reach out to external acts, how they're searching for some sort of entertainment other than German entertainment that doesn't have quite the same immediate connotations that so much of German culture had in the 1940s and 1950s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky needle to thread in a way, because I don't want it to seem like, you know, everybody's rushing off and completely casting aside German forms in favor of particularly American forms. But, because German local forms are still very popular. But, you know, the 50s and the 60s are this, great period of American influence in particular in Western Germany as a whole. I think particularly for young people, the ones who were too young to have physically experienced the war, that generation of people born in the early 40s through the early 50s, those are kind of the main actors in my book in terms of, when I'm talking about youth. They are, whether or not they're consciously thinking about, I want to reject everything that my parents stood for, there is this undeniable attraction of American forms, of foreign forms, because they take you outside of your own workaday existence. And one of the things that when you read people who came of age in the 50s and 60s in West Germany, they talk constantly about, it was such a boring era, there was nothing going on in Germany. The German word they use is spießig. It's kind of like, uptight bourgeois emphasis on orderliness, cleanliness, and respectability. And for a lot of young people, this felt very suffocating. And so, they're looking for other impulses. And, again, not every German teenager becomes captivated by American rock and roll. In fact, it's kind of a minority taste, certainly, in the late 50s. But there is a sort of widespread interest in the other, right? The other defined in a lot of different ways.
So how then does rock and roll come to take root in St. Pauli? Who are the key figures involved in it, and what are the venues in which this introduction is taking place?
Well, there's one guy in particular who seems to have been the one to really set up the first viable club in Hamburg. His name was Bruno Koschmider. He was not a local. He was somebody who sort of landed in St. Pauli after World War II. He was a nightclub owner, And he was also a guy in the 50s who you can literally picture this guy trying to make a living any way he can. He dealt in jukeboxes and vending machines. You know, he's trying to break into the nightclub business. He ends up being he owns a couple of real B-movie movie theaters. You know, so this is a guy who's trying to hustle. This is very San Paoli. This is very also 1950s. And he's got a nightclub that is sort of struggling along. And, you know, he founds this club in the late 50s. It's called the Kaiser Keller. And it's in the basement of a building at a place called Große Freiheit number 36. So he's got this club. He experiments with, you know, hiring all different kinds of live acts. There was a trend, for example, in this period of, they called it Indo rock. These are sort of Dutch Indonesian instrumental groups who could play the rock and roll sound, but they totally filtered it through sort of Dutch Indonesian guitar elements, sort of like Hawaiian guitar, which, you know, that's a sound that had been, you know, familiar to Europeans actually since the early 20th century. So, you know, so these Indo rock bands are kind of a hit, but they were professionals. You know, they had stageware, they had equipment, and they weren't cheap. So Koschmider is sort of a notorious penny pincher, and he's looking for cheaper alternatives. He's also got a jukebox in the Kaiser Keller, and this is not by any account a guy who really cares much about rock and roll as music, but he does seem to have a pretty good sense of what sells. And so, you know, he's got some rock and roll music on the jukebox, but, you know, generally the clientele of his club was, you know, the not terribly unusual mix of, you know, sailors on leave, the occasional tourist who wanders in, people who work in the local entertainment industry, sex workers, you know, that kind of thing. But he makes a connection with some people from Liverpool. Now, this is where the Beatles lore actually helped me a lot in writing this book. You know, the story of the Beatles is documented down to like the day. I mean, there are literally, you know, what happened this day in Beatle history. And there was a figure from Liverpool, a guy by the name of Lord Woodbine. He was from the West Indies. He was a partner in a nightclub in Liverpool with a guy named Alan Williams. He had been to Hamburg. He had also met, you know, so this is where the port cities thing comes in. Liverpool and Hamburg are both port cities, right? So you get this sort of traffic of people. And he had encountered a German sailor in Liverpool who said to him, you know, back in Hamburg, there's all these nightclubs and they're always looking for bands. They're always looking for acts to book. And so, you know, through this connection of these people, Koschmider back in Hamburg gets connected with Williams and Lord Woodbine in Liverpool. They basically make an arrangement. They meet up in London at the Two Eyes Coffee House, and they sign a contract in which Williams says, I will provide you with some of the bands that I manage back in Liverpool. Now, this was a roster of, you know, several bands. The Beatles were one of these bands. But they were definitely considered in Liverpool at the time to be like, you know, one of the worst bands. There was even one of the other musicians said, oh, my God, don't send the Beatles over. They are so crap. They're going to make the rest of us look bad. But, you know, contracts were signed. And so Koschmider ends up importing these bands from Britain who are young. They come relatively cheap. And they can sing rock and roll in English, right? And that's something that Germany did not really have at the time. And so, you know, these bands, he starts, you know, having these bands on his stage at his club, and they very quickly become discovered by local fans of the music. And that's where, by late 1960, you start to get a sort of almost like a small cult of people, several dozen people who start avidly coming to the Kaiser Keller to see these bands. And then, you know, as these things happen, San Paoli, the entertainment district, is a small world. Other people start to hear about the success of the Kaiser Keller, which now all of a sudden becomes like a hot destination. So Kochmied is the first. And then the second character that I profile in the book is a guy named Peter Eckhorn. He's a very different character. He's local. He grew up in the neighborhood, and he's also young. You know, Kochmieder is an adult man. He's well into his, I think he's almost 40 by the time he's setting up this club. But Peter Eckhorn is 21. So he's a young person, and he's got more of a sort of, you know, instinctual feel for this music. He likes the music as such. And he's also the son of a sort of, I don't know if dynasty is the right word for it, but, you know, in San Pauli, there are these families who have had businesses for generations. And Peter Eckhorn is the grandson of a guy who founded a very famous entertainment venue right on the Reeperbahn, right on the main drag. That venue was a hippodrome, right? So, you know, I ended up looking into the history of hippodromes, right? These are the things you never think you're going to be looking at when you set out to write about rock and roll, but there you go. Hippodromes are big venues where people would go to watch horses race. You could also get up on the horse and ride the horse around the ring. I mean, this is like drunken, you know, spectacle weekend behavior, particularly for sailors on shore leave. And, you know, this was sort of like, you know, working class amusement of the first half of the 20th century. But by the late 50s, you know, the hippodrome was kind of, you know, it was pretty old fashioned. It was not, you know, it was not sort of the great draw that it had once been. And so young Peter Eckhorn is set to inherit the family business. And he looks at this hippodrome and he says, you know, we could do something much more modern with this space. And so he decides to have the hippodrome converted into a big dance club, a rock and roll club. And by this point in time, you know, the Beatles have been playing at the Kaiser Keller, other acts like Tony Sheridan. You know, this has definitely gotten a local following. And Eckhorn sort of befriends these guys and sort of draws them over, woos them away to his new club. And, you know, once the music ends up on the Reeperbahn, which is a much bigger boulevard, it's kind of the main drag, very, you know, heavily neon lit, you know, it's where the masses would throng on Fridays and Saturday nights. You know, putting that music on the Reeperbahn gave it a much bigger profile, much higher exposure. And it also kind of, it broadened out the audience for rock and roll. So it's no longer just played now in this sort of basement venue, but now it's in this sort of brightly lit place right on the main drag. So again, rock and roll in the early 60s in Hamburg is proving to be a good business proposition. And, you know, again, I think that's one of the important things that I discovered is that, you know, rock and roll is good business. And you know, that's why it continues to grow in the early 60s. And then the third entrepreneur who comes into the story is a guy named Manfred Weisleder. And Weisleder is, to me, the most interesting. He's a guy, he is a transplant from Dortmund, Germany's industrial heartland. He moves to Hamburg in the mid-50s, again, kind of, you know, seeking to make his fortune. You know, he's an electrician, and he ends up becoming an electrician for several nightclubs in the district. And he is sort of famously thrifty, and he is able to parlay his savings into buying a couple of clubs of his own. And very quickly, he ends up owning nightclubs up and down one particular side street off the Reeperbahn. This is a place called the Große Freiheit. And, you know, in 1962, he is he owns a very successful place called the Erotic Nightclub. Okay. So again, the histories of sex and entertainment are very much intertwined with the story of rock and roll in San Pauli. The authorities come to Weisleder and say, you need to provide a better fire exit for the Erotic Nightclub. Well, the Erotic is in the upper floor of a building at Große Freiheit number 39. And after, you know, you can read all the details in the book if you want to, but basically he ends up acquiring the movie house that's in the first floor on the street level. Now, movie houses had been a very popular attraction in San Pauli for decades. One of Germany's first permanent movie houses was founded in the area around 1900. But by 1960, the audience for going out to the movies is also diminishing, right? Television. Germans, now have more comfortable homes, much more income to spend on sort of, domestic entertainment, the older generation in particular. And so, cinemas are sort of going bankrupt left and right. So Weiss later acquires this bankrupt movie house, and it was called the Sternkino. The German word for star is Stern. And so he renames this new space the Star Club. And he literally sets about making this old movie house into the best rock and roll club on the European continent. That was absolutely his ambition. Again, he's not a guy who sort of comes into this as some great rock and roll fan, but he understands good business. He sees the success of these other clubs. And so, he's like, okay, we're going to do this and we're going to do it better than anybody else. He taps into local expertise, and he taps into people who are friends with bands. And so, you get this sort of coming together of capitalist, enterprise, entrepreneurship with fan culture, youth culture, people who really know the music scene, such as it is developing. And the Star Club sort of brings all these things together. And the Star Club opened in April of 1962. And when it opened, it was instantly very popular. It was, it was well advertised. There was a big buzz around this new club. And it was impressive by all accounts. I mean, you can see sort of photographic evidence of this. But it could fit hundreds of people. It had the best sound system. And it literally became the place to see and be seen. By the end of 1962, it's drawing thousands of people every weekend, and even weeknights down to down to San Pauli. I could continue on, but if you want to interject here.
No, I was actually thinking about how you described the acts are coming in. And one of the interesting points you make in your book is that, the acts themselves are very famous. The Beatles, of course, being the most famous of them. And we think a lot about, how the Beatles influence music and how the Beatles, shape the audience, shape fashion and so forth. As you explain in your book, though, when you're talking about these acts, it's a two-way street. I was especially struck by how you point out that the Beatles, in some ways, became more professional during their time performing in Hamburg, and how these other acts are coming in and they are being influenced by the situation. You're actually seeing the rise of groups such as the Liverbirds, who are in effect, I mean, they're creations in, say, the UK, but they really are having their moment in Hamburg. They're having their moment in the Star Club, where they have that audience and really make their greatest impact upon music. So how exactly is that exchange taking place? And who are some of the acts that are really benefiting from that opportunity that Hamburg is giving them?
Well, starting with the Beatles, I mean, when the Beatles come to Hamburg, they are completely rough. They are, they've just hired Pete Best out of nowhere to be their drummer, just to literally make the trip. But coming to Hamburg, they have to play this grueling schedule of basically 6 days a week, 7-8 hours a night. They're constantly having music practice on stage. So Hamburg makes them into a, certainly a more professional act, but it also makes them into just qualitatively better musicians. The other thing that happens to the Beatles is that they meet young Germans. When they first come to Hamburg, they are not particularly, they're not particularly there because there's any great love that they have for Germany. John Lennon, Stu Sutcliffe, who was the Beatles' original bass player, initially they think Hamburg is awful. They're living in next to the men's toilets behind this grotty old movie house, right? you know, again, these are stories that are sort of famous to Beatles fans, but, you know, what I tried to do in this book is take these stories that Beatles fans know and actually, you know, put the history behind them, you know, give them the sort of more rigorous contextualization. But they end up meeting young Germans who come, the first one to show up at the club sort of comes by accident, you know, middle-class son of a banker, you know, art student. And he sees these Brits on stage, and he's just completely knocked out by this, because he's like, you know, there's nothing in our German experiences like this. You know, these guys are they're channeling something that is so interesting and so wild. And, you know, so this German guy, Klaus Bormann, he gets so excited that he drags his friends to come out. And, you know, his friends, they are all instantly captivated by these Brits on stage. And Astrid Kircher, who passed away recently, she's really, in many ways, one of the key figures of my book. She is, she's a young photographer. She's just out of art school. She's working as a photographer. She is that sort of, you know, new, independent, fashionable young woman who takes her art school training and her own modernist aesthetic, and she applies it to this very raw form of rock and roll. And, you know, she famously falls in love with Stu Sutcliffe, the Beatles' first bassist. And, you know, they sort of, this becomes the nexus of this interchange between these young artsy Germans and these young Brits. And the Beatles themselves go from being kind of initially hostile to the Germans, you know, for reasons that are not that hard to understand, to becoming, you know, hugely interested in hanging out with them, learning from them. Paul McCartney was the one who could speak the most German. You know, John Lennon didn't even really try. You know, there's different degrees within the group of how interested they are in this. But, you know, none of this is planned. You know, none of this happens by design. But it's this sort of accidental meeting between Germans and Brits that I think ends up creating this incredibly important cultural transformation, right? The Germans definitely are getting something out of this. These young Germans are growing up in a society that is, you know, pretty repressed, you know, a society that's trying to put the Nazi past behind it. That is obsessed with, you know, hard work, putting your nose to the grindstone, being productive, rebuilding. It's a very emotionally repressed society. You know, you're not encouraged to speak about your feelings. You know, who cares about your feelings? And so these young Germans, when they encounter rock and roll on stage in this live environment, they sort of perceive this as a really great cathartic moment for themselves. The musicians, you know, these young people from Britain, this is also a transformative experience for them. And, you know, I structured the book around different groups of actors because I was really interested in the lived experience of rock and roll in this particular time and place, right? So, you know, so I have a chapter that's about the musicians, and that's the part that talk somewhat about you know, them and their experience coming out of Great Britain, which is itself also, you know, a sort of an emotionally uptight society. So these young Brits are coming to Hamburg. They're coming to St. Pauli, this place that is completely about, you know, a 24-hour party culture. It's about, you know, sexual spectacle, sexual commerce. You know, these are sort of people in their late teens. So, you know, you can kind of imagine that, you know, this is a pretty exciting place for them as well. So they're coming of age in, you know, this licentious outpost in Germany's most liberal city. I mean, Hamburg is definitely Germany's most liberal city in this period. So they're coming of age sexually, but then they're also, you know, in these encounters with these young Germans, you know, I think there's a lot of emotional growth that happens for them as well. So, you know, there's different people that I write about in the book. Sort of the Beatles are certainly the most famous, but another guy that I interviewed at length, his name is Gibson Kemp. He was also a musician. He was a drummer. He was a drummer for several groups, but most famously with King Size Taylor and the Dominoes, you know, another band from Liverpool. Just, you know, there's sort of dozens of these bands who are hired over from Britain. Once they catch on, there's just like an endless supply of them, and they keep coming over. But Gibson Kemp, you know, he ended up staying in Hamburg. He ended up marrying, he married Astrid Kircher back in the 60s. They divorced. He ended up marrying another German. He now owns a British pub in Hamburg, right? So, you know, he is sort of one of these people who talked to me at great length about how, you know, for the musicians, they weren't thinking terribly deeply about the great implications of all of this. But looking back on it, you know, he realizes what a great, this was a momentous change in his own outlook. It was a broadening out of their own horizons. You know, if they had stayed at home and stayed in Liverpool for the rest of their lives, they would have probably maintained a fairly provincial outlook. So, you know, so the larger point here is that, you know, there people on both sides of the exchange are getting something out of it. And they all pretty much agree that they increasingly came to feel like they were part of something that was much larger than themselves. You know, and I make the argument that Hamburg is a really important place in terms of the creation of a sort of transnational youth culture that by the late 60s will become sort of the global language of youth across, you know, certainly across the Western world and arguably across the globe. I would love to talk more about the Lyrebirds too, but I think let's you know, maybe you need to interject here.
Well, I was actually going to say that that was one of the things that fascinated me. You argue in some ways that being in Hamburg gave a lot of these groups more freedom than they had in Liverpool. It certainly gave them more fame. But you also talk about this intersection between you also talk about the audience. And discussion of the audience is really interesting, in part because it gets to a lot of what's happening, you know, sort of the impact of this upon the Germans. But as you explain, there isn't a whole lot of discussion about audience in so much of the history of music. It's just assumed that they're there, or it's just that they're taken as fans. And as you explain, you've already discussed it to some degree, you're talking about a generation of Germans who are processing this new music that's there. It's not, I mean, for some of them, they're encountering it, as you were describing earlier, through jukeboxes, through what they might have overheard from, say, servicemen from America and Britain who happen to have brought over the music with them. But you're also talking about how what's happening in Hamburg is creating a rock and roll audience in Hamburg, in Germany, in Western Europe, that is going to be so influential for decades to come.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, fandom has a history, and, you know, it's a history that has not really been much written about, but that's definitely starting to change. So, yeah, I mean, you know, at a sort of formative stage of conceptualizing this book, I encountered Christopher Small's work on musicking, right, coming out of musicology. And, you know, he puts the emphasis on what people do with music. That's what creates meaning in music. And, you know, that really appealed to me as a social historian, right? I'm really interested in, you know, how do people live through these changes? How do people create culture in their daily lives? And so, you know, looking at fans to me was absolutely an indispensable part of the story. You know, because, I mean, fans are not just passive consumers. They actively sort of, you know, recreate the works that they consume in their own lives when they do things like, you know, putting up a picture on your bedroom wall of somebody that you admire, when you start to change the way you dress because of, you know, some role model. So I was really interested in trying to get at how fans are part of making this scene. And, you know, for the early stages of the Hamburg scene, you know, these German art students are really crucial. There are so few people at that point that, you know, you can talk about this small group of people having a big impact. You know, there are also sort of working class fans of this music, too. You know, the Rockers with a capital R, you know, they were the fans of Elvis who dressed in that manner and, you know, rode motorbikes and that kind of thing. So they're also a very important part of the story. But the art student fans, you know, end up sort of pushing the culture into something different. You know, the rockers, in a sense, would have probably been content had rock and roll stayed the same as it was in 1956. Whereas, you know, the art students, you know, they're bringing all kinds of other cultural impulses. They're interested in like French chanson, for example. You know, they've got their art school training. So they're sort of pushing, they're part of pushing rock and roll in this more complex and artistic direction, you know, which the Beatles absolutely exemplify. But, you know, when the scene goes beyond just a small clique of insiders into a bigger phenomenon, you know, with the opening of the Star Club, for example, you know, when you've got thousands of people who want to pack into this club on a Friday or a Saturday night, you know, I was really interested, like, what was that like? What was it like to, you know, how did they get to the club? You know, for example, the Star Club, when you look at its placement on the street, it was nestled in between a transvestite bar and, you know, a regular bar. And it's on a strip that's full of strip clubs. There's a Catholic church a few doors down. The sort of little Chinatown is a few doors, you know, further in another direction. So, you know, again, I keep coming back to this notion of the intersections of all different kinds of impulses in this relatively small space. You know, I was very also interested in the social geography of where these nightclubs were situated. So, you know, what does it mean then when you're, let's say, a 16-year-old girl in 1963, and you want to go down to the Star Club? You've heard about this cool place from some of your friends. Okay, are you allowed to go down there? Would your parents let you go there? Okay, let's say your parents would let you go there. Let's say you were honest and actually told them where you were going. Right? Okay. Then there's the police. The police have officially deemed the District of San Pauli a morally endangering place for youth. Young people were technically not supposed to be in the area to consume amusements. And so, you know, so, okay, let's say your parents let you go down. Okay, well, now you've got to deal with the possibility that you might get, you know, stopped in the club, and certainly you'll be asked for your ID. If you're underage, you have to leave the club by 10 o'clock at night. But let's say you don't want to leave, right? So, thinking about this sort of lived experience of the average person who never becomes well-known, who never, you know, really leaves many traces, that was something that I really tried to reconstruct. And that's, you know, I end up having to sort of turn to police files for a lot of that kind of, you know, archival evidence. But, you know, getting back to fans as an important part of the story, I think the other part that was very important to me is that studying fans is a way that you can get a more gendered perspective on this whole story. you know, with a few exceptions, the bands are guys. The nightlife scene in San Pauli is more conducive to the male customer, although there are certainly women customers as well. And so looking at fans was important to me as a way to get at the story of young women and teenage girls, you know, because they are far more likely to be found among the fans than they are up on stage. And, you know, there's a lot of, I spoke to some people who were fans back in the day, you know, talking about their experiences. And, you know, for some, it is a sort of sexual experience. There is certainly the groupie thing, you know, early on, before, you know, grippy even becomes a word. But quite a few of the people that I met didn't necessarily want to construct their experience in those overtly sexual terms, you know, for whatever reasons. You know, these women are, you know, some of them were grandmothers. Maybe they didn't want to, you know, maybe they didn't want to have themselves known in those terms, even if stuff happened, right? So you kind of have to take people somewhat, you know, at their word there. But one of the things that came up frequently was they talked about friendship. They talked about the friends that they made by going to the clubs. They talked about their own peers within the scene. So, you know, and they also talked about loving the bands, but not necessarily in a sexual way, but sort of looking at the bands as, in some cases, well, these are young people like myself. So, you know, if they're up there doing something creative, you know, some of them talk about, I felt more empowered to do creative things in my own life. So, you know, sort of trying to tease out the history of that fan experience is something that I tried to do in that particular chapter of the book.
I like how you incorporate the photos into it. And I'm thinking about two in particular. The first is the cover photo, which I think really makes that point about the female experience, because if you look at the photo closely, at least half of the fans that are depicted in it at the foot of the stage are women. And yeah. it might be slightly more than that, some of the ones you can't pick out. But then you have a picture in the chapter itself where you have, it's predominantly women. It's the one on page 107 where you have the afternoon show at the Star Club. And it's mostly women. And so you have that sense of it. But it's also fascinating because if you look at these pictures closely, it reinforces the point that you make in the book that, I mean, this is a point at which you're seeing that they're engaging in something that is oftentimes regarded as very daring, but we're not talking about, you know, the punk crowds of the 1970s. We're not talking about people that are showing up in fishnets and t-shirts. I mean, they look very demure. They're very made up. It's that sense of how they're venturing out there into this culture for the first time. They're experimenting. They're enjoying it, but they're doing it in ways that seem very that can sometimes seem very restrained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, I think that's right. And you know, they're pushing at borders, but they're, you know, they're not busting through them, right? You know, yeah. You use the punk analogy. But nonetheless, that pushing at borders is important and it's significant, right? And I wanted to sort of rescue, particularly the sort of teeny bopper girl, I wanted to rescue her from the condescension of posterity, you know? I mean, because, gosh, if you read, you know, rock journalism from certainly the past, I mean, there is no more figure of derision than the teenage girl, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Paul McCartney routinely being dismissed as like, oh, he's just writing music for teeny boppers. And I'm like, well, what about the teeny boppers? I don't have an experience. You know, that girl in that particular photograph, you know, she looks to be about 12 or 13 years old. She is the experience on her face, right? She's experiencing a moment of joy. So, you know, I really tried to take seriously, what did that mean to someone like her? By the way, this is a brief moment in the history of the Star Club when they were allowed to have Sunday afternoon concerts in which children, literally 12, 13, 14 years old, could be admitted to the club. These were actually quickly shut down by the city because, again, you know, the very notion that you would be bringing children into this disreputable district, that was more than they could bear. So that photograph was taken at a very particular moment. But you know, the photograph that's on the cover, you know, when I was asked to select, you know, a cover image, I found this in the Getty catalog and it just knocked me out because I was like, this photograph explains everything that I'm trying to do in this book. You know, as you mentioned, there's an almost total gender parity. These girls and boys are not particularly glamorous. They're not particularly avant-garde in their look. They're certainly fashionable. But, you know, the sort of regularness of it was also really attractive to me. You can see what they're drinking. There's bottles of Coke and there's a couple of bottles of the local beer. But that's it. You know, that's all there was for sale at the club, Coke or beer. And that's pretty much it. 50 cents or a Deutschmark. Nothing expensive, nothing fancy. But, you know, most of them are there. If they're hopped up on anything, it's more likely to be Coca-Cola, maybe a couple of diet pills. So this is not some, you know, heavy freak-out drug scene. You know, that will come much later in the decade. And the other thing, too, their placement, they are right there at the foot of the stage. That closeness between the bands and the audiences was really striking to me as the more I researched what the actual clubs, you know, what the club experience was. There is no great separation between the fans and the audience. And in that way, it is kind of like punk, you know, and I'm somebody who, in my own personal history, I have a real affinity for, you know, I certainly liked punk when I was younger, but I also am a big fan of, like, you know, 60s garage bands and sort of that notion that anybody can get up on stage and do this thing. That notion of the musicians literally emanating out of the audience. And I think, you know, my own personal interest as a fan absolutely influenced my scholarship in this book. You know, I mean, of course, we as scholars have to be rigorous. We have to, you know, maintain a certain objectivity. But I think there's also a value in coming at our subject from a certain insider knowledge perspective. I think that there are just certain things that I picked up on in writing about this time and place that others who write about rock and roll have not always really picked up on, you know. So, I mean, being a fan, I think, helped me to write this book, and I hope it didn't cloud my judgment too much. I mean, I certainly have a sympathy with the fans. I understand.
I would say, looking at your chapter on the Authorities, it didn't cloud your judgment too much because you write about them with a degree of sympathy for the challenges they face. I mean, here you're talking about a very different perspective on the whole scene. I mean, when you're talking about the promoters, you're talking about the musicians, you're talking about the audiences, you're talking about people that are vested in it either professionally or personally. But then you're talking about the Authorities, and for them, it's alien or it's a headache. And yet, as you described, they're having to come to terms with it. They can't just simply, you know, ban it and dismiss it. They have to process it in a certain way. And as you explain, the way they process it, it plays a role in the history of it as well. As you've already alluded to, in terms of who they permit, who they ban, keeping the clubs open, the brief times they try to shut them down, they're, you know, in their own way, shaping the music experience of Hamburg during this time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and again, I think this is where understanding the long history of the place helped me out. You know, as I said before, you know, St. Pauli is a moneymaker, and the Authorities are always conscious of that. You know, even Helmut Schmidt, who ends up becoming Chancellor of Germany in the late 70s, he was Hamburg's Minister of the Interior in this period. And so he's a guy who is basically overseeing policing in the city. And, you know, he sort of famously says at one point, you know, we don't want to become just a sleepy provincial town. You know, we have to allow a certain amount of licentiousness here. And that is a good thing. And all of us in Hamburg know this about St. Pauli, and we treasure this about St. Pauli. He goes on and on about this. But, you know, the one of the other main characters of the book is a guy by the name of Kurt Falk. And Falk he's the local tax official for the district, right? So, you know, the money side of this is a really important part of the story as well. He goes after, in a very open and concerted way, the head of the Star Club, Weisleder. And he goes after Weisleder for back taxes in particular, but also, you know, Falk doesn't like the whole what he perceives to be an atmosphere of lawlessness in and around the club. Now, you know, everybody who was a part of the Star Club audience, you know, whether they talk to me or whether, you know, there are a lot of sort of printed oral histories and things of the club. And they constantly say that, you know, once you're in the club, you know, you're not in any danger of being accosted or mugged or anything like that, unless you get violently drunk and pick a fight with somebody. But Falk is sort of looking at this from the perspective of, you know, an older person who's sort of a guardian of law and order. He absolutely hates the idea of young people coming into this district. He looks at that as just, you know, it's just a slippery slope between a young woman going down to a nightclub like this and her falling into all kinds of bad ways, which will inevitably end in prostitution, you know, and Falk and people in the police, people in the welfare authority system, a lot of female you know, bureaucrats, they are genuinely worried about what could happen to young people. And I don't think that that's an unfounded fear. You know, this is a rough area. And so, you know, there are certainly people acting in good faith to protect young people. But there is also this sort of reflexive policing impulse to, basically view any unaccompanied young woman in particular as a potential prostitute. And so, you know, this is where looking at arrest files, looking at the files of the this particular policing unit called the Youth Protection Squads, right, which is a great name. You know, you find them literally arresting people for very flimsy charges. And in some cases, you know, some of these young women, some of these young men end up in, detention facilities, incarceration. And, you know, so, I mean, trying to sort of, I wanted to give the authorities the same understanding that I give other actors in the book, because I'm trying to understand this scene from multiple points of view.
You have this moment that you describe at a couple points in your final chapter that I thought was really great. And it's the scene where Weisslader is in his club, and it's 1966. And he has this act on stage, and this act who I think it's Jimi Hendrix is playing. And you describe how the audience is just loving what he's doing on stage. And you have Weisslader who's like, what the hell is happening here? And it seems that that moment is the moment where you don't quite present it this way, but it seems that's the moment at which everything is, you get a sense that that's the moment which you're starting to see the changes taking place that's going to bring an end to this era. I was wondering if you could explain what were some of the factors taking place, and why is it that that this music scene, which is so vibrant in the early and mid-60s, comes to an end by the end of the decade?
Yeah, sure. The Hendrix show is, I think it's March of 67. And, you know, this is a moment of generational change. Weisslader, who is incredibly innovative and, you know, really rebellious in terms of his dealings with the authority, now he starts to see something different taking place on stage that makes him the old guy. You know, he makes him the guy who's no longer really in touch. There's quite a few structural things that contribute to the change. For example, in the mid-60s, particularly in the wake of Beatlemania, rock and roll goes from being this sort of niche, basement level taste into becoming, featured everywhere. It's international. It's no longer underground. Parents are buying Beatle wigs and trying to be hip, right? So, so that's one thing. And then there are certain changes that happen in San Pauli as well. San Pauli has always been a place that thrived on selling sex. While rock and roll has this moment, from about 1960 to 67, where it really does great business for San Pauli, the main business of San Pauli has never stopped being sex. And by 67, 68, censorship around sexuality is just collapsing everywhere in Germany, in West Germany. And so more and more sex-themed businesses, come into the area, more and more open prostitution. And this exerts a certain, sort of commercial pull that works against the music clubs. There is also, as I said, this generational change. Not only Weisslader is sort of, becoming the old guy, but also that original audience from the early 60s, those people are now, they're into their 20s. A lot of people are getting married, they're leaving the scene. So there's a generational shift. And the younger generation are, they don't have to fight quite as hard for their right to party.
And, I like how you put that.
Right. So they are really much more open to these more extreme sensual experiences, right? So if you think about, Jimi Hendrix, I can only imagine what it was like to see him on stage in March of 67. The loudness, the feedback, the acrobatics, the overt, the hypersexual presentation, him and his guitar. I mean, this must have seemed to the old guard like, what the heck is that? You know, what is this guy doing? That is Weisslader's reaction to this. He thought that Hendrix was making fun of, you know, rock and roll, and he felt Hendrix's performance was very disrespectful. Whereas these younger people, this younger generation, are looking at him and they're like, oh my gosh, this is great. He is pushing the envelope. And, you know, this is also coinciding with now, you know, the influx of more, you know, I don't know if psychedelic drugs are quite in the picture in 67, but certainly hashish. You know, so the whole the expectations of you know what a night out will be are starting to change as the audience changes. And you know, the Star Club will find itself unable to keep up with these changes. And you know, this is a typical thing. This is what happens with music scenes. There's a reason that it's a scene that's bounded by time and space and place, because scenes change, people move on, you know, conditions change. And what will happen is that the Star Club will not be able to adapt to the new audience expectations. Other clubs will. You know, Peter Eckhorn, who I mentioned earlier, his club on the Reeperbahn, it was called the Top Ten. The Top Ten is able to transition away from so much live music and more into pre-recorded, that sort of disco format, the discotheque format. And they will continue on into the 80s, and they will morph into something else. The Star Club is not able to morph into something else. And Weisslader himself, he, by 67, the Hendrix show appears to have been some kind of watershed for him, too. He'd been fighting with the authorities for years. You know, this rock and roll club has always cost him money. He made his money off of his strip clubs and his erotic cinema. The Star Club was kind of a loss leader for him, even though he loved it and he put a lot of energy into it. And he really cared about, you know, providing an authentic experience for young people that wasn't crass and commercial. You know, he's a really interesting figure. He ends up becoming, you know, one of the key figures in my book, because he becomes active on so many fronts. But by 67, 68, he's tired and he gets out. He sells the club to a couple of local musicians, you know, a couple of guys from a group called the Rattles, who were one of West Germany's most successful beat bands. But they can't make a go of it. And by they close, and you know, this very sort of heavy symbolism, their last show takes place on December 31st, 1969. And so literally, you know, the Star Club ends, you know, on the last day of the 1960s.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I'm continuing to work on some aspects of the history of San Pauli. I'm working on one of the nightclub owners from the 20s and sort of charting his path from Weimar into the Nazi period and beyond. I'm also writing a piece about the show Babylon Berlin, which my grand theory is that Babylon Berlin is a mashup of the 80s, that is a sort of Weimar Republic through the lens of people who came of age in Berlin in the 1980s. And then I'm also writing a very short history of West Germany. So I'm pretty busy.
Well, I do look forward to reading your work in the future. Thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us, Julia. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.